Okay, so I started out really enthusiastically wanting to do a comparison between, I realized, Rand and Nietzsche is just really, really broad. So I wanted to do a comparison between not their metaphysics or their epistemology. I realize that Nietzsche doesn't really have much of a metaphysics, really, when you unpack it. I reread Stephen's book on Nietzsche and the Nazis last night. And so I decided I was going to do a comparison between their sense of life, like what is the sense of life of Ayn Rand's versus Nietzsche's sense of life. And Ayn Rand's The Romantic Manifesto was the first book I read at 19 years old of her books. I actually started with the nonfiction, The Romantic Manifesto, I started with, and then I went to The Fountainhead, and then I went to Atlas Shrugged. And I've read that book so many times, and I really got into the notion of the sense of life last night, and I hit a dead end when it came with comparing her sense of life with Nietzsche's, because I found some problems with the notion of the sense of life that just I couldn't move beyond the problems I found. So I wanted to just really talk about Ayn Rand's sense of life. It's a rich, rich notion, and it's inextricable link to art. And some of the problems that I ran into, for the first time, really. I mean, I guess I was reading it really, really critically since I had to give a talk on it. I've taught a number of her books, almost every other book besides this one, The Romantic Manifesto, in my classes. So my thesis is, I'm going to tell you what my thesis is going to be, and then I'm going to give a sort of like a 15-minute breakdown of what I find problematic and what has sort of stumped me. My thesis really is going to be that Rand, I find in her discussion of her sense of life or the definition itself, that she conflates what I take to be codified emotional responses, feelings about the world, people, events, into what I think are really psychological states, into metaphysical issues. So there is nothing that is that necessarily inheres in the nature of reality about our emotional states or feelings that would warrant calling them metaphysical value judgments. I think they are psychological reports. That's going to be my thesis. And I never really thought about it that way. I sort of just had read Rand's notion of sense of life uncritically until I started thinking about comparing her notion of a sense of life with what I was trying to reconstruct out of Nietzsche's corpus of a sense of life, his notion of the heroic individualism. So let me just read again. My thesis is going to be, because I want it to be very clear, is that I think Rand conflates codified emotional responses, feelings about the world, people, and events into what are, I think, psychological states, into metaphysical issues. I don't think there's anything that necessarily inheres in the nature of reality about or emotional states that would warrant calling them metaphysical value judgments. I think they are psychological reports. So I think Rand turns what are nothing more than the psychological states and issues of psychology into issues of metaphysics. All right, so that's going to be where I'm going to start. So she says a sense of life is a preconceptual equivalent of metaphysics, an emotional, subconsciously appraisal of man and of existence, and that it sets the nature of a man's emotional response and the essence of his character. No, the first issue that came to mind was I thought that what set the nature of emotional responses was the conscious thinking one has done or one has failed to do. So I think that when you use the term appraisal, that a sense of life constitutes a subconscious appraisal. I don't know, as an analytically trained philosopher, I'm going to have a problem here, because appraisal by its nature presupposes conscious judgment. I don't know that you can subconsciously appraise anything. Appraisal is a kind of concept that presupposes a conscious state of mind according to well-defined standards against the backdrop of, say, what constitutes, you know, bravery or excellence or certain kind of virtue or a particular phenomenon, and well-established criteria for all the ways of falling short of that particular concept, like all the ways of falling short of excellence or bravery. I don't know that there would be an unconscious, subconscious way of appraising bravery or excellence. So that's one of the first markers of a way in which I think a definition of sense of life by introducing a sort of subconscious appraisal of man and his existence is problematic for me. So the act of appraising any phenomenon can neither be subconscious nor mediated by, I think, also emotions. So she says a sense of life is a preconceptual equivalent of metaphysics, an emotional subconscious appraisal of man and his existence. So I don't think, again, that the act of appraising any phenomenon can be subconscious nor mediated by emotions, which Rand says are not tools of cognition, right? There are feelings, but they're not tools of cognition. But is determined by man's cognitive faculty, his mind. So I want to turn to page 141, and I'll just read it to you very briefly, of the Ayn Rand lexicon, which is taken, the quote that I'm going to read, I think is taken from the Objectivists, in which he says that man is born with an emotional mechanism, just as he's born with a cognitive mechanism, but at birth, both are tabula rasa. It is man's cognitive faculty, his mind, that determines the content of both, and man's emotional mechanism is like an electronic computer which his mind has to program. And the programming consists of the values his mind chooses. But since the work of man's mind is not automatic, his values, like all its premises, are the product either of his thinking or of his evasions. Man chooses his values by conscious process of thought, or accept them by default, by conscious associations, on faith, on someone else's authority, by some form of social osmosis or blind intuition. All right, so a conscious process of thought, or we accept them by default, by some sort of subconscious association. So a sense of life is formed by a process of emotional generalizations, she says, in the Romantic Manifesto, and it's a subconscious counterpart of a process of abstraction, which involves classifying and integrating. So one of the problems I had with this, and I thought really long and hard about this, is I'm not sure that a sense of life, which is formed by a process of emotional generalizations, a subconscious counterpart of a process of abstraction, that the mind can do all these things and classify and integrate subconsciously. Now, in Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, we do see that a process of automatization occurs after consciously identifying certain reference in reality, right? So I can identify a table, a chair, an ottoman, and so on and so forth. These are actual reference. And then I can form the abstraction furniture. And the abstraction is an abstraction because it's something that actually doesn't exist in reality. It's based on a concept that unifies the reference that I perceive in reality, and it's far removed from my conscious, my perceptive awareness. So the concept furniture is not something I can ostensibly point to. I'd have to point to all the different reference in reality, like table, chair, and so on and so forth. So I'm not sure that a sense of life is something that can be formed by this process of classifying and integration. If it's being done by means of this kind of emotional generalization in a subconscious way that she articulates, I'd like us to discuss that. So that's one other problem I had. And what exactly is the nature of a subconscious metaphysics, right? Or to subconsciously hold a metaphysics. I think that's just as problematic as saying we can hold a subconscious morality, when morality clearly is a set of clearly defined and held principles that regulate conduct, among other things, and guide the choice of one's actions, that direct one's actions and guide the choice of one's values. So what Rand here calls an unconscious metaphysics, I think, needs a set of necessary and sufficient conditions for what constitutes holding a metaphysics or a metaphysical view. So a subconscious metaphysics seems just as vague or conceptually vague as subconscious epistemology or subconscious politics. And what Rand describes as preconceptual or subconscious metaphysics is, in this sense, a loosely inchoate set of emotional experiences and attitude and orientation that one develops towards a particular phenomenon or phenomena. And again, it seems to me that to codify these associative feelings into anything that could resemble a metaphysics is really playing loosely with the term metaphysics, right? So, or again, an emotional attitude or a psychological set of codified experiences to which one has experienced, it's just that. It's a set of emotion. It's a set of psychological states. I wouldn't call it metaphysics. And also, as importantly, Rand says that the key concept in forming a sense of life is a concept important. Now, she says a couple of things that have me thinking that she's speaking a little bit elliptically here. She says the concept important is not a value judgment that can be answered subconsciously or implicitly. She says value judgments are unconsciously held, and they belong to the realm of values, but at the same time, they are different from moral values. I don't know if that's an equivocation, but I would say that values are inseparably tied to morality. So there are two things that are going on here that I find problematic, folks. One is if importance or important is a value judgment, that is a species of morality, not metaphysics. But she says that it is a metaphysical issue. She emphatically states that important is a metaphysical issue, that it's a value judgment also that belongs to the realm of values, but is different from moral values. And I say that I'm having a little bit of a problem with that, because values are inseparable from the realm of morality. And again, I'm not sure why the term important would be a metaphysical issue, as opposed to, as she rightly says, belong to the realm of values. So that sort of slippage between that conflation and that slippage between metaphysical issue, and the realm of values seems very, very problematic to me. I could go on and on. I have like 7 pages here, which I'm not going to read, because the last time I talked about Rand, it was very, very technical, and I would rather just leave it there, and because I think those two issues are very, very important. One is the conflation of psychological states, or what I'm calling psychological states, into an issue of metaphysics when they belong in the realm of psychology. So Rand is transplanting psychological states and calling them metaphysical states. And then the second issue of conflating that which is important as a metaphysical issue while simultaneously calling it a value judgment that belongs to the realm of values, but saying that it's different from moral values. I think the whole issue of the sense of life gets a little bit murky here from a definitional standpoint.
Well, as always, you bring up provocative points, and we are very fortunate tonight to have not just Professor Hill, but we have other members of our faculty, Stephen Hicks, who's in the room and has written a book about Nietzsche and the Nazis, and of course, our founder, David Kelly, and Professor Richard Salzman. So I'm going to defer.
And can I say that you should all get Stephen? Stephen, I reread your book from cover to cover last night, and it was just fabulous.
I've sent him an invite to come up on stage, but he might be, who knows, out at dinner or something. So I'll see if he changes his mind. But David or Richard, did you have some thoughts or questions for Jason?
Yeah, I did, and I'll try to be brief, but Jason, thank you so much. This whole issue of sense of life is something I've never fully understood. It's aesthetics and the psychology relevant to it is not my strong point. So I find your discussion very interesting, but let me just make a brief comment about your two central points. One is the distinction between psychological states versus Rand's description of an implicit metaphysics. Psychological states, I hear what you're saying about the psychological states. But at the same time, epistemologically, any cognitive state, any conscious state has some content in reality. And I think what Rand is getting at is those psychological states are about reality as such, even if implicit. And we do have implicit premises that, I mean, one of the functions of psychotherapy is to uncover assumptions we've made that we don't know about that underlie certain emotions. I don't know how exactly this applies to the issue of these sense of life issues. So I'll just leave it there. But I do think that the issue of the describing something as a psychological state is valuable in its own right. But at the end of the day, the psychological state has to be about something. So that's one thing, and that something, you know, is in reality, truly or falsely grasped as it may be. The other thing about importance and values, I take what you say, and I think there are some issues about Rand in the sense of this. My sense overall has been this for a long time, been Rand overemphasized or exaggerated the control of one's conscious mind over one's subconscious, including emotions. But be that as it may, there are normative judgments that are not ethical per se. There's aesthetic judgments about the quality of an artwork. And there are, and I take it that judgments of importance are normative, yes, but in the sense of this is significant. I must pay attention to this, as opposed to the many other things I could pay attention to. That's a normative judgment. It may or may not be ethical, but I'm just suggesting that the realm of the normative is broader than the realm of the ethical. So I'll leave it there, and be interested in your follow-up and the other discussions. Thanks.
Right. I mean, I do think that the last, just to comment on your last statement, that that's true. But I do think that when the concept of important is introduced as belonging to the realm of values, that the realm of values, as I said, is inextricably and constitutively tied to morality. That is, it's a species of morality. And you cannot talk about, I mean, she does say that not everything that is important has a moral upshot to it. Like, just like how, you know, so something can be important, like a bar of ice cream can be important to me, but that's a, well, non-contextually, just simply more, just simplest, you know, just speaking in a vague and non-contextual manner. It's not really a moral issue, or it's not, it could be, because I could suffer from diabetes. Let's just say if I decided to dye my hair purple, that's just, that could be important to me for aesthetic reasons, but that's just not a very moral issue. But when you import something like important being imported into the realm of values, and those values in some sense are not outside the realm of moral neutrality. Because when Rand is talking about a sense of life here, she's not, and especially in that chapter about, in those two chapters, philosophy and sense of life and art and sense of life, she is not, and they're linked to the ideal man and so on and so forth. This is not a discussion of morally neutral things that are important. These are things that are important which have a moral upshot to them. So we're not talking about important things that are of value to me, but which are outside the realm of morality. We're talking about things that do have a moral upshot to them. So if she wanted to make that distinction, I think she should have used something, a different terminology. I think the terminology should have been different. Because there's a superficial way of talking about values, and then there, which most people, when they do talk about values, which are, she says values are that which we act to gain and or keep, which is an incomplete definition of values. I mean, in the objectivist ethics, she gives a much, much robust account of values, that they're life-enhancing phenomena that all living species must pursue. So values in the rich context that she's discussing it, she's discussing them, are not separable from morality. And so, yeah.
Jason, just a quick comment. You know, Rand, in those essays you mentioned about sense of life, if she were writing purely as a psychologist, there would not be the unmistakable attitude that a benevolent sense of life is better, more human, the right one to have, rather than the malevolent sense of life. I mean, you just read the essays and the way she says it. If she were speaking purely as a psychologist, And some, I think some objectivist psychologists would present it this way. It would just be, this is a fact. Human beings have these attitudes, you know. We can go on to talk which are more helpful and more life-supporting, but that's a value judgment. There's a non-value judgment here in analyzing the nature of the human mind. And so anyway, that's a short point, but thanks. I know some of the others who are more conversant with this thing, with this material.
Thanks, David. Stephen is driving, but he is listening, Professor Hicks, and he approves of this discussion. So I'm sure we'll all get together later and be able to explore further. I don't know, Richard, if you are driving or grading, but it's great to see you here.
I'm neither driving nor grading. I'm sitting on my front porch listening to this most fascinating discussion. Jason, David, Jason, 3 points. I'm overwhelmed by this analysis. I love it. I feel it. That's not a bad thing. I have had the same issue. I love the whole Ayn Rand view of sense of life. But I, like you, have read it over and over again. And I'm impressed, by the way, that you read, that was the first thing you read, and you've come back to reassess it. I want to say one of the things I most love about the Atlas Society is that it has a place for reassessing and assessing Ayn Rand, because we love her. We love her philosophy. And therefore, we're willing to say, what the heck? Why did you say that? What does that actually mean? And it's one of the things I love about you, Jason. My thought is the same thing. You brought up, and I'm looking at the Ayn Rand lexicon because that's the best way to get to it. It's subconscious, it's emotional, and yet we know she said you cannot use emotions as tools of cognition. And my particular interest in this is her view that the American sense of life is saving us at a time when the philosophy is ruining us. Of course, she said that 40 years ago. And I think we would say today that the sense of life has eroded so much. But philosophically, Jason, I'm looking at the same passages you do. A sense of life is a preconceptual equivalent of metaphysics, an emotional, subconsciously integrated appraisal. I feel the same way you do. Appraisal to me sounds conscious, not subconscious. And even though I like the idea, I'm not sure how she gets there or validates it. And then later in art and a sense of life, again, I'm looking at the lexicon. Just go to the lexicon and put in sense of life. She says, quote, a sense of life is formed by a process of emotional generalization, wow, which may be described as a subconscious counterpart of a process of abstraction. I won't quote beyond that, but my first reaction to phrases like, wow, how can that be? There's a difference between conscious and subconscious. And I thought the objectivist view was whatever's in your subconscious came from your conscious, came from, derived from, was derivative from what you saw firsthand, so to speak. So I think of the subconscious as not secondhanded in the way of like a Peter Keating type thing. But what do we stock our subconscious with? The stuff that comes through our consciousness. And so I'm a little... Unless I'm misinterpreting you, Jason, I'm a little disturbed about why she places such credence on this subconscious emotional power when, on the other hand, she says emotions are not tools of cognition. And then the last thing I would say is, this is just as a promo, this is relying on Nathaniel Brandon. And I'm not in the business of promoting Nathaniel Brandon, but Nathaniel Brandon was a genius. And maybe partly he was a genius because he met Ayn Rand. But I don't think she would have caught up with any of this stuff without having been influenced by Nathaniel Brandon. So I just want to be on the record for saying, for the Atlas Society, not like it's the official position. I'm not saying it's the official position, but man, he was a genius. And she knew he was a genius. And this stuff is a discussion, the stuff she's doing here, is a discussion of the relationship between the conscious and the subconscious. And Jason, everything you said about, my gosh, I've never heard this phrase before, the codification of the psychological into the wow, I've never heard that before. It's brilliant. It's new. I think it's new. But I just wanted to put a pitch in for, okay, just because Ayn Rand disassociated from Nathaniel Brandon, let's not forget that he wrote a bunch of great stuff and influenced her. So that's a bit too much, Jason, I know, but I'm curious as to your reaction to that.
Well, thanks a lot, Richard. I criticize my heroine, so I'm going to try to save her also. I agree with everything that you're saying, and I share your frustration here. It's maybe this is a question of which comes first, the chicken or the eggs, right? Maybe Rand, in some sense, is speaking as if what happens when a sense of life already gets formed. And I'm thinking here in a very innocuous passage on page 25 of chapter 3, Art and Sense of Life, where she says, I'm going to read the passage because I think it might save the day, where she says, the psycho-epistemological process of communication between an artist and a viewer or reader goes as follows. The artist starts with broad abstraction, which he has to concretize to bring into reality by means of the appropriate particulars. The viewer perceives the particulars, integrates them, and grasps the abstraction from which they came, thus completing the circle. And here's the brilliant part of what she says. Speaking metaphorically, the creative process resembles a process of deduction. The viewing process resembles a process of induction. So maybe this whole thing of sense of life is maybe she's armchair quarterbacking. Maybe she's establishing the processes by which it's a heuristic device. Rationally, here's how a sense of life would have to come about in the way that concepts come about. That is explaining how a child would grasp the concept of furniture. It's not, and how it becomes, certain concepts become automatized in our consciousness. Maybe she's just saying this is the way a sense of life in an adult would properly become established. And everything that I've talked about in terms of generalizations and automatization and is already a procedure that would come about after a conscious awareness of certain processes have been brought to consciousness. I don't know if that's putting words in a dead woman's mouth, but that's the only way that I could think of sort of rescuing some of the analytic shortcomings that I identified, where she said the creative process resembles a process of deduction. The viewing process resembles a process of induction, where what we have to do probably is, as viewers, take the position of the creator himself or herself in order to come up with a proper understanding of how a sense of life comes about. So maybe what she's giving is not really a psychological account of how a sense of life really comes about organically in an individual, but how the proper methods for how one would establish something like a sense of life, if that makes sense.
And Jason, I don't think in all the years I've read this book that I've seen a take of like your take, which has made me think of it differently. So I thank you for that. But let me ask you something. Do you think it's derivative? When I think of growing up in the 60s, here's how I personalize it. This could be totally arbitrary, so throw it out if you don't want it. When I grew up in the 60s, what was my sense of life? I don't know. My parents were conservative Catholics. Fast forward to today, and I'm an atheist objectivist. What was my sense of life? I don't know. They told me you can do anything. Work hard, study hard. Is that subconscious? Is that? Then by the time I read Ayn Rand, I'm like, this is awesome. Who is this person, Ayn Rand? I thought he was a man. Is that Salzman subconscious ready to? Because that's really important in terms of changing the culture, right? If this is true, if her theory is true, there are millions of people, Jason, ready and willing and able. So I'll stop there. But you see what I'm saying? Is this a derivative in the sense of unless there's a conscious family or group teaching that tells you you're important, go do something in life, and you can. Otherwise, people will not have a good sense of life. I don't know. I'm still thinking about this.
Well, she says that a sense of life can change, right? And but she says in philosophy and sense of life, a given person's sense of life is hard to identify conceptually because it is so hard to isolate. It is involved in everything about the person, in his very thought, emotion, action, his choice and value, the way he smiles, the way he talks.
Wow. Yes.
The way
yes.
his manner of moving.
Yep.
Right.
Wow.
So she says introspectively, one sense of life is experienced as an absolute and an irreducible primary, because the thought of questioning it never arises. We never think of questioning our sense of life. But a few pages earlier or later, she says, but we can change our sense of life when emotion and reason are brought into harmony, when they're not occurring incongruously, but they're brought into harmony, and there's no conflict between emotion. And she adduced herself. She adduced herself as evidence of such a person. Then, not that she ever changed her sense of life, but as she adduced herself as someone in whom reason and emotion were in complete harmony. There was no conflict.
Yeah. Yes.
Then you can change your sense of life. One could imagine you can start walking more confidently. You can raise your voice.
Yeah.
Right. And you can raise your head instead of walking with a bowed head.
Yeah.
You can brace your shoulders back like Dagny did, you know, when she first met Galt.
Oh, wonderful, Jason. That's wonderful. Yes.
You know,
oh man. So, yeah. Thank you, Jason. Thank you so much.
All right. And I have put the link to the book that, Jason, I think you were perusing, Stephen's book on Nietzsche and the Nazis. So if anybody wants to check that out, I'll also put it in the chat. And my dear friend John, you have a question or thoughts on this?
Hello. Thank you. This is kind of where objectivism meets subjectivism. I mean, this is where the scientific method or positivism or principles of falsification, which involve a second party, that is someone has to make a judgment about confirmation or a process of falsification that's not purely subjective. And so that's where the objectivism aspect comes in. And then it's also the problem of how does someone who is trying to be objective self-examine their mind? It's kind of like how do you know what you know? And that's why this is so difficult, Jason. It's because that's where Rand is treading, is in this difficult area of where it's a subjective analysis of what we want to make objective or to be objective. And then this also gets back to my hobby horse of sociobiology, that is, the origins of human consciousness in our biological history, and how that then interfaces with the axiology of value formation and life as the principal value. And then, of course, where from the title, Sense of Life. Then I guess my question is, what happened to Nietzsche? Thank you.
Yeah, Jason, so maybe a little bit on how you would contrast this discussion with your review of Nietzsche. Want to unmute?
Oh, I got it. I have to unmute. Oh, yeah. Nietzsche and Rand clearly had Nietzsche didn't use the word sense of life, and Nietzsche didn't have I don't think he had a metaphysics well worked out, but they did share a particular sense of life. And Stephen has convinced me. I mean, I shouldn't have read. Stephen gave me that book as a gift when he invited me to Rockdale a couple of years ago, and I read it, and then I reread it last night. And they did. Stephen convinced me that Nietzsche really wasn't an individualist after all. So I've always thought of Nietzsche as a sort of quintessential individualist. And then listening to Rand's talk again last night for the umpteenth time on the difference between objectivism and Nietzsche, and then Stephen's book made me realize that Nietzsche wasn't an individualist. But one doesn't have to have. One can still share a sense of life. So I think in their pursuit of what Nietzsche called the Übermensch, or the superior man, or the superman, or the overman, and what Rand called the ideal, there is a shared sense of life. Although again, Stephen did point out that, and Rand pointed out that for Nietzsche these are biological innate qualities, where for Rand they are cultivated. Man is a being of self-made soul. But nevertheless, there is a sense in which their hatred of mediocrity, their hatred of the inheritance of secondhand values, and their glorification of an ideal, Nietzsche would call it the superior person, an ideal person who has the right, in some sense, well, Rand wouldn't agree that she explicitly states that one doesn't have the right as a superior person or a person of exceptional ability to live by different moral rules than an ordinary person, because we all share the same human nature. But in some sense that both of them are, dare I say, value manufacturers. That is, they create values in the world. And I don't think I'm wrong in saying that Howard Rourke and John Galt, through the vehicle of Ayn Rand created a new moral system, create values. And so Nietzsche's Overman was the transvaluer of values and created new values. And in that sense, they did share, and in other ways too, a similar sense of life as despises of mediocrity, despises of people who simply unquestioningly are second-handers, the title of what was Rand's novel before she called it The Fountainhead, the beneficiaries of secondhand values who just mindlessly sort of espouse them. But in both Rand and Nietzsche, you see people questioning, transcending, and creating values. Now, in Rand, those values are suitable for man's nature as a rational being. I think, again, as Stephen pointed out, in Nietzsche, they are good based on a kind of subjectivism because I created them. In Rand, they're good because they conform to my nature as a rational human being. So the sense of life that I had thought was more widespread between Nietzsche and Rand has sort of diminished, because one is a radical subjectivist and irrationalist, And one is the apotheosis of rationality and objectivity. Rand has a very strong belief in an objective reality that exists independently of one's consciousness. And Nietzsche sort of has the idea that the will, again, is, this is not going to turn into a lecture on Nietzsche, I promise you, but that the will is supersedes rationality, that that rationality has a very minimal place to play in a person's life. It's the will. But also, Rand states that in Atlas Shrugged and Gall's speech, that the will also has a role in promoting the good. I'm sure it's the will conjoined with a rational principle. So I do find a common, less now that I've sort of read other critics of Nietzsche, a common thread in their sense of life, a glorification of the ideal, of the ideal man, what Nietzsche would call the Superman, Übermensch, what Rand would call the ideal man. And a sense of life in terms of a not so veiled in Rand, slightly veiled in Rand, not very veiled in Nietzsche, a contempt for the masses. Rand sort of threw the jury scene and in the Fountainhead, made up for this, but in Atlas Shrugged, you see it more where the bitterness is more prevalent in that part of Rand's personality, an absolute contempt for, you know, for the housewife, for the Hausfrau, for the ordinary man, for the common man. I don't think Rand, much contrary to what she said, had much respect for ordinary common, the folks next door. Like Nietzsche. So there's a common sense of life that's running through both of them. Hatred of mediocrity, hatred of the ordinary person, a glorification of greatness, an exaltation of people with superior strengths and abilities and talents.
Thank you, Jason. All right, we have 11 more minutes, and Norm has been waiting patiently, and so we'll get to his question. But if there's somebody else in the audience, please raise your hand. We might be able to squeeze you in. And also, I want to remind everybody who is here, you will have a spectacular opportunity to meet with all of our scholars in person a week from Thursday, October 6th in Malibu. We're going to be having a day of panels on objectivism and various topics. And also then Jason will be speaking on the main stage at our gala with Camille Foster and Stephen Hicks on A New Vision for Diversity. So if you're in Southern California or up for making a quick hop of a flight, I hope you'll join us. Norm, do you want to unmute yourself?
I do. Thank you for hosting. And thank you so much, Professor Hill. Incredibly stimulating and thought-provoking. Please let me know if the audio is not okay. So I don't know if I have a question as much as an attempt at an observation and an attempt to understand what we're talking about. Again, I'm not trained as a philosopher, journalist really. So what I often try to do is reduce ideas to their most digestible forms. So let me know what you think. My sense of what Ayn Rand was trying to talk about with a sense of life in many ways is covered by Freud's sense of the unconscious mind. It's all of those things that we're bringing to the table precognitively. Although these forces, this system influences our cognition and also influences our emotions. It's distinct from emotions. You know, it's a structure. Again, if we bring in Jung, then maybe some of it is universal, this concept of the collective unconscious. But nevertheless, I feel like at least partially she's referring to these like we're saying, pre-conscious or unconscious forces that are beyond our control. What's interesting about this is that nobody, no matter how brilliant, is above the fray when it comes to, say, the resistance, that is the barrier between the unconscious and the conscious, and the or consciousness, and the degree to which we are controlled somewhat, not entirely, or influenced certainly by these unconscious forces. And I'll just say finally that I love the ideas that you're sharing about the will and the ability to become a master, in the simplistic terms, master of one's own life. You know, these imperatives, really, which I think Ayn Rand and Nietzsche share, to overcome the mediocre and the pedestrian. So if there's anything in there that that resonates with you, Professor Hill, I do enjoy our interactions here on Clubhouse. So I wonder if you have any thoughts about what I've shared, if there's time, if I haven't gone on too long.
No, well, thanks, Norm. I mean, Ayn Rand must be turning in her grave after almost 40 years of being dead. I'm just kidding, to hear you associate her with Freud, whom I actually love Freud. I mean, I have a deep appreciation for what he has to offer. But I can see where people would align her with falling into the trap, and she would consider it maybe a trap, falling into the configurative unconscious template that Freud himself created. But I don't think Ayn Rand would associate herself in those terms, for either the simple, or one might say, depending on how deeply invested one is in the unconscious, for the simple or simplistic reason that Rand actually thought that through a process of introspection, really, really radical introspection, and also, but more importantly, Norm, by consciously changing one's premises, and she didn't think that it was, she distinctly said, that's why I don't think it's simplistic, she distinctly said it's not an automatic process. It takes a lot of emotional rehabilitation for this congruence between reason and the subconscious premises that are guiding behaviors to come into alignment. But Rand is not a rationalist in the philosophical sense, but Rand is someone who did think that by consciously changing your premises, your consciously held premises, your convictions, your through reason, not through faith, not through fear of social ostracism or something like that, but you see in reason that you have fallen into error before you pass into corruption, that you change your convictions, that's the first way of rehabilitating your emotions, because emotions are, for her, the result of the thinking that you have done or you have failed to do. For Freud, that's garbage. I mean, for Freud, there's no such thing as just, no, for Freud, it's all about, trauma and going back to the scene of, I mean, you got to be Barbara Streisand and spend 20 years in psychoanalysis and being facetious here, but it's kind of true, right? Going back to the trauma and going back to some sort of unconscious wound that is so traumatic that your consciousness can't bring to consciousness, and you through talk therapy and through free association and the bleeding of the unconsciousness and this therapeutically safe space that Freud provides, or the analyst provides, that you somehow bring to consciousness that which was traumatic, and then the process of mourning can start, and then through mourning, the healing process. I don't think Rand had any truck with that kind of what she would call nonsense, right? It's a matter of sort of changing one's premises, thinking rationally, and it didn't happen automatically. It's not like, you know, you've fallen into error, and then it's kind of like if you're toxically obese and you change your diet tomorrow, you just don't shed 55 pounds overnight. I think speaking analogously, I think it's the same way. The mind has to be retrained and reprogrammed. But it really for her is, and correct me if I'm wrong, anyone on stage, but I think for her it's fundamentally changing your premises that you see in reason is wrong. That's the beginning of altering, reprogramming the subconscious for Rand. That's a very, very different approach from
May I come back to you Freud. Just briefly one
yeah.
time?
Yeah, sure. Okay.
All right, okay, thanks. So I'll just try a little...
2 minutes.
Okay, I'll try to keep it under that. Thank you. And this is something that I got from Harold Bloom, who thought of Hamlet as sort of the original Freudian. So perhaps we can analogize the process of psychotherapy. In other words, just really the therapist remains quiet and the analysand speaks. Perhaps we can analogize that speaking with this self-confrontation, maybe. This is the process. Again, I think that these great thinkers are often all trying to wrestle with the same material, and they put their individual stamp on it. I guess I'll stop right there rather than use up the 2 minutes and see what you think about it. So maybe perhaps that confrontation with oneself maps onto Freud's analysand, laying there and just sort of speaking until one realizes what.
Give him a chance to answer.
Yeah.
I think so. I just think that Rand and Freud, let me just say this real quickly. They had such radically different views of human nature that they don't seem commensurable at all. I mean, Rand had a particular view of human nature of man, and Freud had a particular view of human nature, and the two are so radically different. They might have been striving for the same kind of outcome, but their procedures and their methodologies are so radically different because of their commitment to a particular view of human nature that each had. But thanks.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Very, very good. Jason, this has just been an absolutely breathtaking, magnificent discussion. Thank you so much. And
I'm sorry I didn't get to Nietzsche. I didn't get more to Nietzsche, but
well, we might have to do another one. Thanks to John for getting us back on track. Thanks to David and to Richard, and of course to Stephen Hicks for helping to inform this conversation. And I'm going to toss it to my colleague Scott to let you guys know what's coming up next.
Thank you. Tomorrow at 7 p.m. Eastern, Rob Trzynski is going to be talking the objectivist theory of the family. Wednesday, the Atlas Society asks Robert Zubrin at 5 p.m. Eastern. Thursday, back here on Clubhouse at 4 p.m. Eastern, the Atlas Society asks legendary investor Larry Abrams. That's going to be a great one. And then Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern, Richard Salzman will be hosting another Morals and Markets. And our gala is coming up in about 10 days in Malibu. The link's at the top. We hope to see you there. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you.